Fargo, the new virtual assistant from Wells Fargo, makes banking faster and easier. Like this.
Fargo, what's my checking account routing number?
And this.
Fargo, turn off my debit card.
And this.
Fargo, what did I spend on groceries last month?
And that's just the beginning. Do you Fargo? You can. In the Wells Fargo mobile app. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getFargo.
Terms and conditions apply. Your mobile carrier's availability and message and data rates may apply. Wells Fargo Bank N.A. member FDIC.
Drew and Jonathan Scott here to tell you that American Family Insurance wants to protect your dreams. So whether you're at home singing in the shower,
every note,
or prefer singing your heart out in the car like Drew,
cruising,
you can save up to 23% when you bundle your home and auto insurance with American Family Insurance. Get a quote or find an agent at AmFam.com. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis, and if I sound enthused, it's because I am. It's because I'm drinking some delicious Dunkin' coffee. I believe you should know what a huge fan I am of the Dunks. And something else I'm a huge fan of is the Waffle House. Now, anybody who knows me well knows that it is a frequent stop for me and has been for many, many years. I was the first. It's very cool now. It's very chic now to like say you like do the Waffle House and like wear swag by the Waffle House. And it's very chic. Once upon a time when I was growing up in Atlanta, the only people who you ate at the Waffle House at night, right? It was for truck drivers and for us when we went out at night. And as I became an adult, I would eat the Waffle House during the day. And I was the only friend of mine that did that. And I was way ahead of this Waffle House curve. I'm just saying, okay? Not saying, just saying. In the last 10 years, as I began my career as a runner and obstacle racer, it was the go-to spot after the race. Hey, we're done with the race. Let's go get some good food. Let's pig out at the Waffle House. Because the body is craving calories and craving all that goodness that comes in a delicious Waffle House plate, and you're able to just dig in after a big race. That's what I do. So when I started this podcast, the Atlanta Podcast, of which the tagline is the famous, Atlanta famous, infamous, and anybody else I find interesting, talking to someone at the head of the Waffle House was in my short list of people to get. Like, I got to talk to like the number one or number two guy at the Waffle House. This would be awesome. It's an Atlanta staple. It's a Southern staple. And ladies and gentlemen, today is that day. I get to bring you Joe Rogers Jr., CEO of the Waffle House from 73 to 2012, I think those years are correct, and now is the chairman of the board. And, I hate to even say it, but I feel like I have to, because when I just recently brought up an article about him, it says billionaire. And I'm mentioning it because he's a guy that you would not know was a billionaire. He showed up to my interview in his Waffle House uniform, essentially. And he told me he still spends time in the stores, and I know that he does. A lot of people at the head of things talk about relating to their staff or how, you know, working with their staff, and I think it's a lot of, what's the word, lip service. Joe clearly lives it, is clearly a very bright guy, and I really enjoyed this chat. I don't want to say much else. I just want to get to it. Here is Joe Rogers Jr. and I talking all things Waffle House. And I learned so much, by the way. I learned so much talking to him. Away we go. So I noticed that. I looked up your bio, and I assumed the family was from here.
Born in West Tennessee.
Okay.
Jackson, Tennessee.
Okay.
And after World War II, when my dad got out of the Army Air Corps,
right,
he went to work in Memphis, Tennessee for a fellow named Fred Smith.
Okay.
Who owned several businesses, one of which was a short order restaurant chain called the Tottle House.
Okay.
And he became the Southeastern region manager eventually of Tottle House in Atlanta. and realizing the company would probably get sold because three families controlled it, and there was no ownership for management, he and Tom Fortner decided to start the Waffle House.
Right.
Jim Senior's office, if you go to Ponce City Market,
right,
the old Sears store, look catty-cornered across the railroad track. So go east on Ponce de Leon.
Okay.
Under the railroad track, first left turn, his office was right there on the right. There was a title house, and he had an office behind it. Across from Green's Liquor Store.
Across from Green's?
Right across the street.
So that's where, is that where the Chipotle is now?
I haven't been there recently. I'd have to go look.
So do you have like your first like Waffle House memory? Like do you remember what age or what?
Well, my first Waffle House memory was the opening day at 1:30 in the afternoon on Monday, Labor Day of 1955.
Okay.
Because that's the trivia question.
That everybody asks?
When did Waffle House wash its own windows the first time? And it was at 1:30 that Monday afternoon because I was the window washer.
So you had done whatever you had to do the night before to get it ready, or?
Well, you won't remember this, but back in the old days, they would soap up windows of street front retail stores. And that meant they weren't open.
Oh.
Today, they just put brown paper in them.
Got it.
But they would soap them up and let the soap dry.
Because that blocked it out.
Yeah. So all you had to do at 1:30 that afternoon was wet the windows and wash them. And there wasn't as much glass in old number one, which you can go see.
I've been to that one. They do the little tours.
Yes.
So that's the first one.
Yes.
I actually might have met you there briefly a couple years ago because I've gone to some of those. You know, they have the truck out there and I bring my kids. And so you were how old?
Can I ask
how?
I was eight.
You were
8 years old. Is there a child labor issue there?
I don't think so. Listen, I've been trying to put my kids to work since they were born. Mine are 14, 12, and 8. So I've been trying to put them to work.
When mine were like 8, 6, and 4 or something like that, I had them at what was then the Waffle House at Lindbergh Plaza.
Okay.
On Christmas afternoon, and it had slowed down. I had them in oversized uniforms, obviously. And an Atlanta policeman walked in to get a cup of coffee, and he looked, and he said, "Is that legal?" I said, "Yeah, they're shareholders."
But was there ever a doubt? Like, as you got into your teenage and early 20s, was there ever a doubt, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life? Did you ever think, like, well, maybe I'll be the rebel kid? Or?
Oh, I went off to business school.
Okay.
After the Air Force, right after college, the Air Force and the business school, thinking I was going to go to New York and become an investment banker.
Okay.
Because, see, this was not a Rogers family business. There were, in the 60s, there were four families involved.
Okay.
Joe and Tom Fortner, had 37% apiece, and there was a 14% share, a 10% share. So nobody had real control of the business, and I assume they'd build it up and sell it.
So that was the goal back then, let's build it up and sell it?
I think that was their idea.
Right.
But fortunately, by having all the data on the company when I was in business school and you needed to write a paper in one of the courses, I would simply use the company data. Small business, you had the data. It was deeper than what you could get in Boston from a local business because you could get superficial stuff, but not everything. And I had all the data, so I used
like,
it. And
like the deep, deep P&L.
Correct.
Right. How many stores were there back then?
Gosh, when I went off to graduate school, there was probably a dozen company-operated units and 25 franchise units because the franchising was exploding. That kind of got away from them. Their idea was to build a small company presence in a few southern cities so that they could have a nice lifestyle.
Right.
The franchising got started by Joe Senior's old boss from the Title House who knew the Holiday Inn people in Memphis, and they just let it happen. And all of a sudden, it started exploding.
And that's not what they wanted.
That wasn't their ambition, but they were willing to let it happen, figuring, okay, we'll franchise a lot, and then somebody will want to buy this thing.
Again, like with this idea that we'll eventually sell it. So in the, what year are we up to now?
Well, I came back to work full-time in 1971, okay, seeing an opportunity to grow the business, probably end up selling it,
right,
and then pivot to investment banking, having had the inside business experience.
Right.
And I would specialize in the hospitality industry. which was booming, of course, back in the 60s and 70s.
Who was the competition in 1971?
Oh, my goodness. If you'd done a poll of people in the industry, we wouldn't have been anybody's answer to anything. You had Denny's from the West Coast.
Right.
You had a company called Sambo's, which was probably in the 70s the best 24-hour restaurant chain in America.
Right.
They were from the West Coast. You had Howard Johnson's, which today should be the largest sit-down restaurant chain in the world, and they may have one restaurant left.
What happened to that's Hojo's? Whatever happened to I went to Howard Johnson's as a kid. What happened?
Exactly. They just faded away. It was, well, if you study the industry post-World War II, it's not the concept that fails. It's debt, leadership, or the toxic combination of high debt and poor leadership. And that's what happened to some of these companies.
Can I ask you a quick sidetrack? Did you watch Mad Men?
No.
Okay. Well, they did this. Now, Mad Men was fiction, but they touched on, I mean, you know what the show is, right?
Mm-mm, no.
It was about the advertising industry in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And they use some real world events. These are fictional people. But they were showing a scene where, like, how do we get people to come to McDonald's? Right? Like, what's the marketing to, like, you're not at home, but you're here, and this is your family getting together, which is, you know, kind of crazy because nobody thinks of McDonald's that way.
Right.
We think of cheap fast food, but, like, that was the marketing back then. So, with all that competition, what was the kind of like the ad spend, or where, how did you, other than I'm driving by and I'm hungry, right? How else did you think you were going to get people in the doors?
Well, being 24 hours and the lights always on, you
right.
establish a presence and an image in people's minds.
Right.
In the late 80s, one of our suppliers shared some research with us, which we've never done market research, and it showed that Santa Claus had 98% name recognition. McDonald's had 89% name recognition in the core Southeast, and we had 87. And I said, wait a minute. We don't spend any money on advertising, and we're within 2 points of McDonald's that spends a gazillion dollars.
Right.
Very effectively on advertising. So there's something else going on here. So we've stayed away from the marketing. We've never even collected the marketing allowance that was allowed for in our franchise agreements.
So you would sell the rights, and they're supposed to give you a cut so that you'll quote unquote, like, hey, you can use our branding, and you never even collected that?
Well, no, we collected the royalty fee. They would pay us an initial, small initial fee, which we made no money on. Then they'd pay us an ongoing royalty fee of 3 or 4% of sales. But practically all the fast food franchises and others had an allowance where the parent company could collect up to 4% for a marketing fee.
Got it.
And they had to spend it on marketing.
Right.
And we've never collected that fee. It's built into the franchise agreements, but we've never collected it.
Well, I want to go back to this thing you mentioned about why things come and go. I'm fascinated by this stuff. I'm fascinated by sociology. I'm fascinated, you know, in our lifetimes, the amount of things that we've seen come and go. So believe it or not, I'm 49, right? Big 50 next year. I know I don't look it. You don't have to say it. It's okay. So I was born in 72. And if you would have told me that there'd be no Tower Records, that there'd be no Circuit City, right? Like all these. So there's even this. Have you heard of that book, Good to Great, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Jim Collins.
So in Good to Great, they talk about how plenty of companies can make it 20 years even, right, as the industry leader worldwide, but can't make it 50. And what are those things, right? So one of them is what you mentioned is a leader that doesn't train people to be better than him, right? This concept of if it's Lee Iacocca, what happens when Lee Iacocca is gone?
Right.
So how have you guys done that over this many years?
Well, we've tried very hard to create a multi-generation succession machine, if you will, in the company operation. One of the things we learned is our franchisees don't think that way.
So how do they think?
They're more one generation. Can I make a lot of money? And then, okay, I'll sell the business to somebody. They ended up, most of them, selling back to us. Because none of them really had a succession plan. A couple of them have had family succession, and that has actually worked out, but 2 out of 20 is not a high percentage. So We, on the other hand, are in, you mentioned, about to turn 50. I started work full-time 50 years and 2 months ago here in Atlanta.
Okay.
At the Waffle House.
Right.
And this week, I'm doing the same thing I did that first week. I'll be washing dishes and cooking somewhere. But in the meantime, what we've tried to do is continue to bring along successive generations of leaders in the business through a much more professional approach. Because we're in a consumer service business. You mentioned the life cycle of companies. You got to distinguish between industries. Consumer products go obsolete, and they're replaced by new consumer products.
Right.
The payphone contract at the Atlanta airport used to be the most lucrative business in town. But think about that. There's no such thing anymore.
Right.
Because cell phones made that obsolete.
Where's a payphone? I got to find a payphone.
But the barber hasn't been replaced. That's a service.
Right.
Restaurants haven't been replaced.
Right.
They're innovative concepts. The Chipotle self-service model versus
right.
our table service model. And it's not that we're that good, but so many of our table service competitors have left.
But you are that good. I'm going to tell you something, okay? First of all, I have so many questions for you, but I just somewhere in my early 20s, right, before I was as wise as I am now about business, about anything, all I knew was if I go to Waffle House anywhere, I'm going to get really quick service by somebody who's really sweet. How is it at all these different restaurants, the Waffle House waitress is equally as kind and knows when I need my coffee refilled, like the things that y'all do really, really well that doesn't, you know, it's a waitress is not a machine, right? It's a personality. So that's all I knew in my early 20s was, well, I can count on this, right? So I want to know how you teach that.
Well, you hire for attitude and train for skill, as they say.
Okay.
And servers...
But you didn't say that in 1972.
No, but servers with the right attitude. Remember, my dad had been in this business really since the late 40s. And I grew up around it. And I worked as an hourly associate in the 60s. And in fact, I was talking to somebody the other day doing a video at the company. And they asked me a question about why I like to spend so much time in the restaurants. And I said, you know, you think back... In my heart of hearts, I'm really an hourly associate. When I was 14, 15, 16 years old, I'm working 7 days a week, the split shift, that's 7 to 2, 5 to 9, and I'm working with all these hourly associates. And I asked my dad, I said, when I was working as a server some days, I get these tips. I said, what are tips for? He said, well, that's for rent and gas money. Well, I lived at home, and I rode a bicycle.
Okay.
So at the end of the shift, I would give my tips to the servers that worked with me.
Okay.
And I learned what appreciation will pay in dividends.
Correct.
When you express that kind of appreciation
right.
to those servers and admire them for what they do and show your appreciation to them and go in there and help them, get their dishes for them, help them deliver their food. Because that's not what they expect from the bosses.
Correct.
So... We try to get all of our senior management team to work in the restaurants like we're all hourly associates.
Right.
That's the culture.
However, how do you balance that with, if you're in there serving and washing, you do need the 500-foot view, as we say, right? So how do you make sure you're doing both?
Well, you try to get to enough restaurants and enough markets, and as the system has grown, we were having this discussion yesterday, of how do you leave footprints as a leader? How do you go to Texas, spend a couple of days, and leave footprints and have an impact with the people? And it's about simple understanding of what needs to be done and the motivation to do it. If there's a long list of too many things to do and everybody's discouraged, nothing gets done.
Right.
If there's a short list of important things to get done and everybody's enthused, it gets done. So it's a people business.
I mean, it's interesting, though, because you say all these things, and this is what every company preaches, right? They put something on the wall about our vision is people, and we care about people, and you can tell 5 minutes in that place they don't give a shit about people, right?
We're actually going to do a video in a few weeks on something my dad said, which was a little slogan about who's looking out for the poor old cash customer. and because we didn't use plastic back in those days.
Right. And I feel like I've read that somewhere in your literature before, right?
Correct. But I also told him, I said, guys, you got to go get that big framed wherever it is. They painted the wall in my office and they moved it. And it's about like the size of this wall in here. And it's got all of his slogan cards
right
over the years. Because he loved management by slogans.
Your dad did.
Yeah. Tips are to ensure prompt service. Waste is 100% profit. I mean, they just got all kinds of slogans. So I said, get all of those, because who's looking out for the poor old cash customer is just one of those. It's not the only one.
Right.
But management by sloganeering doesn't work for very long.
Correct.
Short term, yes. Long term, not so much.
Well, if your actions are behind it, right? If it becomes this context, this culture is the word everybody likes to use now, right? Like if the employees buy in on it when they see it.
Well, that's the key. You said actions. It's time in the restaurants, night shifts, holidays, weekends, when we all show up. The nice thing about, well, with the exception of these back surgeries I had a year and a half ago, I'd worked every New Year's Eve since 1971, all night long and into the next day.
Right.
So by definition, I was sober all New Year's Eve. How? Now, that's a real record. And I've worked every Christmas Day.
Right.
I've worked every holiday, again, except last year with those back surgeries. And the good news is, even though I'll be stepping much further away from the company sometime next year, I think I know where I'll be every Christmas Day the rest of my life.
How's that on the family life? Do they ever say, can you be with us this Christmas Eve? Can you be with us this New Year's Eve?
Not really. Not really, because they like to come and work.
Right.
And we get time. And the good news is we're not trying to travel to a resort or something, New Year's or Christmas, because you can't get a room anyway. So why not work when other people play and play when other people work? It just works out better that way. But it's time in the restaurants. There's no cash register at our office. And the closer you stand to the cash register, the better your business is going to be.
Because?
You're there with the customer. I might have messed up on Sunday, but I was in a restaurant and a customer came up to me and said, they say I can't get my syrup warmed up. We weren't that busy.
Right.
And one of the servers said, no, it's on a memo. They told us not to do that. And I said, well, the customer and the memo. Let's choose the customer. Customer's always right.
Right.
So let's warm up the syrup. And I asked later, I said, why did we put that out? And they reminded me, oh, yeah, that was just one of the small things. I paid attention to the big things. But with the pandemic and the labor force,
right,
we've got real production issues. We got not enough people, and many of them are brand new, and it's hard enough to get them to just cook normally. And when you throw in a wrinkle, like warm the syrup, or I got a text from a friend in Jacksonville, oh, I'm sorry, you're not doing basted or poached eggs anymore. Well, that really complicates the production system, and we're just not capable of it right now.
Right.
All that mess.
So it was just a temporary...
Probably so. All the customization.
Right.
My friend Bert, who's retired now.
The chili, Bert of Bert's Chili?
Famous of Bert's Chili. He invented it. You say, Joe, we've spoiled our customers because they want to customize everything.
Right.
And they do.
Right.
And you can always satisfy them, but when it gets really, really, really busy, if you don't have the A team on the field, it's a real wrinkle.
Right.
So we're trying to sort through some of those problems.
Well, so let's talk about that. Waffle House is famously open no matter what. You have a weather chart, you know, dedicated to you, right? This is how it's going to be open no matter what, like only a Hurricane 7 or whatever. It's not. So here we are last year, right? The world is shutting down. Service industry is especially hard hit. How soon, you know, March of last year, did y'all sit down and say, okay, what are we doing here? How is this going to work? Like, do you remember, like, specifically the first couple weeks or?
Well, I had those back surgeries in December and January of 19 and 20.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit out of it, but I'm reading about the virus and so forth. And I talk to the folks and I say, we better stress test the business. And they thought 10, 20% down in sales. I said, no. You better stress test it at 75, 80%.
Just by running the numbers when you say stress test it?
Yeah. Exactly. Go ahead and plan for it. And they all looked at me like I had two heads. And they admit it now. And they laughed at me. I thought, okay, that's never worked out very well.
Underestimating you, you mean?
And they asked me later, how did you figure this out? I said, well, you had to realize the virus was already in the mail. It was going to hit the U.S. And it wasn't the virus that crippled us. It was government reaction.
Correct.
Inappropriate government reaction. Not that they didn't need to do something, but can you tell me what our national mission was in fighting the virus? I can't.
You can't tell us today.
No, there wasn't one.
Well, part of that is that what makes up America is states, right? And you can't get states to agree, let alone we had our mayor and our governor fighting over what we should do. So well, I can't blame the national government. You know what I'm saying?
And Disneyland never reopens, but Disney World does. Now, what's the difference between Orlando and Orange County? There's the inconsistency.
Well, you want to hear something crazy? So I have three children. They were home with us for a year. It was not good. I mean, like behavioral issues and all of it. I mean, it was like real talk. It was not pleasant. They're finally going back to school now, right? Second day, some case breaks out. My kids got to stay home 2 weeks. And I thought, well, the Amazon warehouse gets a case, right? I didn't think of this. I read this somewhere. And they have 10,000 employees. And they're not shutting down the Amazon warehouse. So why would my kid, you know what I mean? Like there's no rhyme or reason to any of it. I've just learned I can complain about it on social media or I can just try to make the best of my life with it. But back to you. I want to know how you guys handle it.
Well, we realized we weren't in control of it.
Right.
Even though we had opinions about how you could create a national mission, we didn't have the voice for that. We had some local influence, but not a national voice for that. So we realized we had to be prepared to respond. And when the governor of Ohio shut Ohio down, it was pretty easy to see what was fixing to happen because Ohio is not a monolithic state. You got rural areas, you got urban areas in Cincinnati and Columbus and Dayton and Cleveland. So, well, wait a minute, one size fits all. That got a little bit bizarre.
Right.
So I said, all right, guys. Initially, they were going to close everything down, and then they realized that wouldn't work. Well, that wasn't some new reality. That shows you the naivety of the political leadership to say, we can't shut down the hospitals. We can't shut down the grocery stores. Oh, by the way, if the trucks don't roll, they don't get resupplied. Oh, by the way, if the Waffle House isn't open to feed the truck drivers, guess what? Are we going to Ohio? No, let's not go to Ohio. Let's go someplace else.
Right.
So it's street sense, and the people making the decisions didn't have street sense. But we had to respond. So our business went from 100% to 20% in 3 weeks. Three more weeks. And this is where the leadership team at the company really excelled. I had a few hand signals, but they did the work and made the decisions. They had it cash flow neutral at 20% within another 3 weeks. They were going to borrow a lot of money.
Right.
And I said, what are you going to do with that? Oh, liquidity. I said, okay, last time I checked, liquidity meant it would be sitting there in the account and you could see it. So it's not going to disappear, right?
How do you make these problems seem so simple, Joe?
They are.
Yeah, but most businesses aren't open 100 years because it's not that simple.
Well, business is pretty simple. Finance is pretty simple. Math is pretty simple.
Make more than you spend? Is it that simple?
That helps. That really helps if you want to endure. But most people try to complicate it. It's like insurance. Insurance is a simple commodity, and they try to complicate it so they can make money with it.
Correct.
Finance is very simple. And when people try to complicate it, it's not because it's necessary. It's because they want to make money doing it somehow. Life's not that difficult.
But to be cash neutral, it meant you probably had to let a lot of folks go, right?
Oh, yes. We ended up furloughing a lot of people. The good news was we understood exactly where the government support level was so that those people were, give or take a little bit, about equal. We reduced comp for others who kept working throughout. And then we came back starting last summer, and we refilled all their potholes. So we made up all the money they gave up during the height of the pandemic. And got them back to their normal total amount of compensation. And basically by having practically no debt. We have some leases. Leases are debt. The accounting profession struggles with that, but leases are debt. It's right. That simple. We had a lot of wonderful landlords that either forgave rent or postponed rent. We've subsequently made all of them whole.
Right.
But what happened was they got it to cash flow neutral. But just before they ran out of cash.
But this also goes back to what we talked about before, is that if you're taking care of people, you've got some trust in the bank. So when you say, we're going to make you whole as soon as we can, they're not like, oh, there's another empty promise. They can hang in there with you because they trust you.
We didn't say that on the front end. We didn't know. You got to remember, going into this tunnel.
Right.
Dark.
There was no light.
No light at the end.
Right.
If there was, it looked like the train coming towards you. So we didn't tell our landlords we're going to make it up.
I meant your staff, though.
We didn't tell the staff we're going to make up your pothole of compensation. It wasn't until probably, let's see, that was March, about August. We quit reducing things probably in May or June. And then by August, we realized we were going to be able to refill those potholes. So that's when we told them.
So before that, were you just telling them, what were you telling them if you didn't promise them that?
Hang on. I did a video for everybody, and I said, look, the best advice I can give you is to hang in there. This too shall pass, and you're going to be better off.
That's one of my favorite phrases.
Hanging in there with us. Math rules. And I talked to one of the leading politicians in April, and he says, I just don't know when this is going to be over. I said, well, I do. He said, when? How do you know that? I said, you don't care when I run out of money, but you care when you run out of money.
Mm.
And go check your tax collections, sales tax, fuel tax, and other things. And in just a few months, you stay on this path, you're going to have to lay off teachers, government workers, and you don't mind if I lay off workers.
Right.
You're going to struggle when you do, so you're going to reverse course, and that's exactly what happened in America. How many municipal employees anywhere in America got laid off? How many teachers got furloughed? And the burden, that's where the mission was not shared. The biggest lie in the whole thing was we're all in this together. No, we weren't. No, we weren't. Think about it. The people making the decisions, I classify them sometimes as the haves, once again in history, kicked a lot of the have-nots to the curb. That essential, non-essential, everybody's job is essential to somebody.
Right.
And you didn't need to shut businesses down. You needed to set up the conditions, social distancing, ventilation, mask, sanitation, whatever the conditions were, and say, right. Now, if you can meet those. So commercial airlines in the U.S. never stopped flying domestically. Would you be safer eating in a Waffle House for 30 minutes or flying Delta for 2 hours?
Right.
Delta's a great airline. They did
very few
great
people. Very few people in those seats, though. I flew during that time. It was great.
Yeah. And we had very few people in the restaurants.
Right.
But where they shut us down, we had no people. As opposed to, well, no, you can stay open, social distance seating. Mass, ventilation.
Right.
We got the best ventilation in the restaurant.
Right. And you took the menus off the table, which I have to say, making that funny sign with the menu is a tradition of mine. So I was right. Very upset about that.
I understand. It's one of those temporary inconveniences.
I will say, because I don't know if they told you, but I am a big Waffle House fan. One of the questions I ask at the end of this podcast while my Atlanta guest, well, we'll get to it because I'll ask you, but I'm a huge Waffle House fan. So during the pandemic, I went a few times. I don't remember exactly how many, but I usually go with my boys. There was one location, and it wasn't that long ago. I want to say, where was I? I want to say maybe Kennesaw, where it actually was takeout only, which I was surprised. It was the only one. All the rest of them did the big glass, you know, separators. These guys were like takeout only. I was very sad.
Well, we had some communities early on that were all over the board.
Right.
Governor Kemp changed all that when he yanked back all the local authority.
Right.
But for example, Brookhaven or one of the small towns.
Right.
We had to be to go only when just down the street we could be dine in.
So depending on the county.
We had those inconsistencies at the very beginning. Then it kind of ironed itself out. Now, we have done a lot of to-go only recently for two different reasons. One is pure staffing, labor market.
Right.
When we don't have enough help, we're allowing what we call play calling. You can, like, if you have a couple of restaurants in a market and you don't have enough a third shift, close one and just fully staff the other restaurant. Or go to go only. The other is the violence on the streets, and we don't want to put our associates in harm's way.
So like downtown you closed, you mean when the shit was happening?
They're corridors.
Right.
In Atlanta. Major roads where it's the gun violence, and there's more drugs, there's more alcohol. What happened? You put a lot of people out of work, which means they had nothing to do, and you gave them a lot of money. I'm glad for them to have money. Unemployment money, stimulus checks, you gave them a lot of money. But what'd they do? They also lost hope. Remember all those people that got furloughed, all those people that got laid off? They didn't have the reassurances that life was coming back to normal. You had part of society on the path of hope, which everybody was on for the most part before the pandemic, if you go back and look at the economy. And then all of a sudden, a huge portion of the population are on this path of despair. I got time, I got money, and I'm despairing. What do? I go crazy. Mm-hmm. I go nuts. I get out and party. I drink. I do drugs. I get a gun. I start shooting. I don't know what the consequences are going to be. And look at what's happening. You see it right here in Atlanta. We see it across the country in a lot of communities. And it's sad because it was totally preventable if we could have kept people busy and kept them on the path of hope. That was the big lie about we're all in this together. If 70% of your population has a hopeful path and 30% has a path of despair, you're going to have a social problem. And that was predictable from the front end. So we're living with it, and we're adjusting to it. We're even closing some shifts. We preemptively, for the summer, with a list of restaurants, I don't have it in front of me, said, no, we're not going to operate third shift in these locations for the next couple of months.
It's too dangerous.
We don't want to take a chance. I see the incident report every Tuesday for the incidents of the prior week. I read last week's this morning, and as somebody pointed out to me, Joe, it's gotten kind of random. It used to be we could predict whether it's Dallas or Houston or Atlanta or Columbus, Georgia or Albany, Georgia, or wherever, where the tough night shifts would be.
Right.
Now it's kind of random.
Right.
It's not the traditional spots. It's broken out in lots of places.
Before I forget, make sure you let your PR person know that we spoke of this on your free will. I know that she wants to make sure, I think, that you're buttoned down. And I'm willing to have an open conversation with you about anything.
Oh,
so,
sure.
Okay. Yeah. Because I knew we talk about the pandemic some, obviously, but I didn't plan on taking necessarily that route. But let me ask you, what at first my wife was watching a lot of CNN, right? And I couldn't even watch it. It was too depressing. The president was saying different stuff every day. People are yelling. Like, there was just so much kind of craziness. I just found it better to, like, not watch and listen. If something's important enough, I'll find out. I don't need to watch 20 talking heads yelling at me and people fighting. But what statistics were you watching? Like, it was a year. What did you look for hope or direction, or how were you operating on a week-to-week basis?
Well, remember, we had a clear account of the shifts we were open throughout this. And even with out of the 1,950 restaurants, with 700 of them closed, that meant 1,200 were open, 400 open 24 hours. So you do the math. How many shifts, how many people work in the shifts, how many individual shifts worked, hundreds of thousands, and how many COVID infections?
At your stores, you mean?
In our stores, employees. And it's a very, very, very small fraction, very small. So you realized that with the right precautions, you could mitigate the infection rate. And that it wasn't going to be huge. There are 350 million people in America, and far, far, far less than 10% have had COVID. And yet, think about what we put the country through. Yes. You remember the original mission was to let the medical system get on top of things.
Correct.
Give them time to get the equipment.
Get all the PPE. And
get the therapies, the drugs that could treat people.
Right.
For the severe cases. Get the ventilators that treat people.
Right.
And then we'll work on the vaccines and we'll eventually get somewhere. Well, the vaccine was a huge success. A year. Basically 1 year. I thought Warp Speed was a pretty good name for it.
Right.
And they came out with the vaccine. And this morning, I heard a news report where college kids, there's a rumor that college kids are buying fake vaccination cards. I thought, wait a minute, you can walk in CVS and get a vaccine for free, but you'd spend $25 or $50 to buy a card that says you got vaccinated? So it, whether it's...
But I'm saying, in terms of profitability and when can we reopen, all that stuff, what were you looking for? What were you watching? Because there's just a lot of garbage out there, as you're saying.
Well, we had no decisions to make. All we had to do was respond. Whenever they allowed us to do whatever, we did it. We knew we could reopen safely. We knew we could seat dine-in customers safely.
Right.
We knew we could be to-go only.
But how tough was it to some people obviously found new jobs, right? So how tough was it to be like, hey, come back to work. Well, sorry, I'm working somewhere else now.
Oh, getting people back to work was crazy, and it differed by state depending on what the rules were. Because unfortunately, the federal government made a mistake, and they enhanced the unemployment benefits by state, which means to get the money, you had to avoid work.
But that's always the case with unemployment.
Well, they could have routed the payroll money through the businesses. Remember, the data they have about all of our businesses is sales tax. So you could immediately see how much anybody's business has dropped. They also get payroll taxes.
Right.
So you just proportion.
But now, I mean, one thing is common sense. Now you're talking miracle worker. You expect them to do that? To actually, like, business by business and figure out what they should
Germany
be paying?
Germany did it.
Well, right. Europe makes a lot more common sense decisions than we do.
Apparently, they figured out a way to funnel the employment money through the employers. If you had given us the money, we would have kept all of those people showing up at the restaurants. We'd have had the cleanest restaurants you've ever seen, because they'd have been spending time cleaning if we didn't have the customer count. And we would have kept them supported, but also busy and in their routine. And emotionally, psychologically, they would have had hope. I've still got my job.
Joe, you're making an awful lot of sense. Have any of your coworkers suggested you run for office?
No.
No one has?
No. All they say when I walk in the restaurants is, Joe, could you get the dishes?
Because they know that's your specialty?
That's my specialty.
Well, but as a company, when you do have money, right, and you do have attention and eyeballs, you do have influence. So have you ever tried that route, or you think the system's too mucky to mess with?
No, you got to make decisions in life. And I think building this business was a decision I made, especially after I got ownership control of it in 1978. I thought we were going to sell it back in the early 70s. And it wasn't planned. I didn't plan to end up with control of it. It was a real simple situation. One of the fellows passed away in the 70s from cancer. So we bought his interest back in. One of the fellows decided to go be a franchisee, so he cashed in his interest. And then my dad and his partner, not in the Waffle House business, but got into the real estate speculation business and ended up owing a lot of money. And I worked all of that out for them. And as a result of that, they basically got the value of the business at the time, and I got control of it going forward. So now I'm the dog that caught the bus. What do I do?
Right.
And my dad said, well, you ought to build it up for a few years and sell it.
Right. We reoccurring theme here.
Yeah.
But every time it gets to be that point, you just think, you know what? I'm going to hold on to it for a little bit longer.
Over time, I kind of thought about it. I said, wait a minute. It's an enduring concept. If the Waffle House concept doesn't work anymore, personalized service and food doesn't work anymore, then the world has really changed. How do we develop an enduring business model, and which we've tried to do, an enduring culture, an enduring financial model, which means avoid debt, and an enduring approach to ownership, because we share the ownership with all of the associates. So it's not, it may be family control now, but we've got 7,000 shareholders, and people are shocked when they hear that. And so, yeah, we let everybody participate in the ownership.
My go-to order these days is the hash brown bowl, okay, which is relatively new. How often and how does something get on the menu? Because you're right, we're going to serve you breakfast, right? Or 24 hours a day, we're going to serve these certain things, eggs, bacon, waffles, right? And that's a new dish. How does something end up on the menu as a new dish?
Well, I mean, you'd have to visit our super secret test kitchen. I'll give you a glimpse. The hash brown bowl was developed in Asheville, North Carolina, across from what we call the Skyland Waffle House, where my son was living in a rented condo with his new baby, and I visited.
Okay.
We took the stroller and the kid. We went down to a restaurant that served like Chipotle, the bowl with the rice and
right.
the beans and things. And we sat out there, and he was saying something and about a bowl. I said, well, son, create a hash brown bowl. And he did.
And that was it.
And that's it. And we decided to put it on the menu. And it's been a big hit. And we got hash browns.
Right.
We don't have rice.
Right.
But we got eggs and sausage and bacon and whatever else you want to put on it. And
right.
You can... And put a little ketchup, A1 sauce.
I'm a Tabasco, hot sauce, a little Tabasco myself.
And you got a heck of a dish there.
Right.
So it's got to fit the production, and you need volume. Having a lot of low volume items on the menu, they go stale in the commissary.
Right.
So.
That's what I mean. You want to add something to the menu. You got to change all the menus. You got to tell people how to serve it. Like, I know you guys have your little symbols with your, like, turn the spoon this way, turn the jelly packet, right? It's not just, hey, throw it on the menu like there's one store. That's what I mean. Like, how it's tougher than people think.
Oh, yes. Yes. People used to say, well, that's a minimum wage job. That's a low skill job. I said, oh, really? You think that's a low skill job? Then why don't you go try to be a server or a cook, and I'll take them in the restaurant. And pretty soon they're overwhelmed.
Right.
And they said, well, why about minimum wage? I said, no, our servers make a lot of money. We have to use the minimum wage legislation to construct it and follow the overtime rules. But our cooks are $14, $15 an hour pre-pandemic and higher than that now. Not the brand new beginners.
Right.
But they don't stay at that beginning wage but 3 to 6 months.
Right.
And then they're earning more at the full wage.
Right.
Because they're very, very valuable and highly skilled.
Yes. I learned that at a very young age, just watching them, right? Sitting at the barn, like watching them do their magic, and this woman's calling out these crazy terms, and they're just flipping things and making the magic happen. So I love the Waffle House. I grew up in Atlanta, eat there all the time. If I travel somewhere else, there's no Waffle House. I don't expect to see one, and I live my life. I was traveling once in Arizona, and I got off the highway, and I saw a Waffle House, and I couldn't believe it.
What side of town were you?
Well, I just didn't think y'all were west of Mississippi, let alone Arizona.
We opened the first restaurant at I-17 in Dunlap, Unit 254, in 1975.
Well, in my experience, I hadn't seen many once I get out of the South. So I was thrilled. And guess what? It was just as good. Service was just as good. Everything tasted the way I wanted it to taste. So my question is, have you wanted to expand more, right? Because there's a thing that, like the Waffle House... It is this Southern place, Southern hospitality, my sweet Southern waitress, all of it, right? And that person, not that you can't find good people everywhere, but you understand what I'm saying. It's a certain thing. So have you thought, well, let's just dominate the West? I mean, like, where do y'all draw the line on expansion, I guess?
Well, you had to be there to see it as it evolved. In the 70s, I took over completely operationally in 1973. Got control in 1978. We were growing like crazy, and we had a company base of operations in Atlanta, Dallas, and establishing Phoenix in Tucson.
Okay. I might have been Tucson where I was, by the way.
And from there, we were going to radiate out with franchisees that we would service operationally from those company markets. And we overran our supply line.
Mm.
In 1980, I realized I could build them, I couldn't run them because we wouldn't leave good people in Arizona because we'd need them back in Texas or back in Georgia or Florida. So I said, wait a minute. And at the same time, those competitors from California were building in our backyard. Now, if you're a 24-hour restaurant operator and you can build in my backyard, is it your fault or my fault? And I got to thinking about that.
Right.
I said, why am I struggling? And I was actually beginning to tiptoe into and look at California and stopped. Unit 481 in Goodyear, Arizona, on the west side of Phoenix, is the furthest west we go. And I thought about going to California, and that's when I realized we'd overrun our supply lines of people. Why not just fill in the markets we had until we got much stronger? And we felt like we needed to get more consistent. Our franchise operations were, we had some that were better than the company. We had some that were worse than the company. So we said, we just got to get control operationally.
You can't tell me you know the number of every one of these darn locations, do you?
Not the newest ones, because I hadn't been in them enough. But the trivia question is, Bert and I were working the night shift one night. Now, this goes back about 9 or 10 years. And somebody who probably had a little more to drink than they should have says, well, how many restaurants are there? And Bert pulls out a piece of paper, and he starts, and he says, oh, there's 1,500, 1,400, whatever it is. He says, well, who knows where they all are? And both of us kind of looked at each other, and we realized I was the only person alive who knew where every Waffle House ever was or is, because there's several hundred used-to-be's.
Right.
I mean, right near here. For example, Glenwood and Candler was number 3. Claremont and North Decatur was number 4. Church Street in Decatur, near that McDonald's on the north side of Decatur, was number 5. Glenwood and Moreland was number 6.
What's the current Glenwood one?
2209, I think, the one down by Maynard Jackson High School.
Right.
And when they said they want to go back there, I thought, oh, really? Because the issues we'd had at number 6. Well, that portion of Glenwood's very different than Moreland.
Right.
Right. But the old building is still there at Glenwood and Moreland.
So I grew up off the loop there in Marietta. What's that one? And it's not the streets.
Off Marietta Loop on the east side?
Yeah, and it's
479.
Like, and it's Green Ridge or Glen Ridge, you know the name of that street? It's like a street name that nobody knows.
Right. You got, we'll see, the original ones in out there. 16 was on South Cobb Drive. Down from Campbell's Restaurant. 37 was at Powder Springs Road. 24, old unit number 24, is on Roswell Street between the square of Marietta and the Big Chicken.
Okay. But you know the one I'm talking about?
The one that's been there for years.
Off the
on
loop
Marietta
there.
Loop.
Next to the, across from the Chevron?
Yeah, it's 479. And
What's across from Centennial Park?
That's 1996 Copay. Centennial Olympic Park, we call it.
And 1996, was that intentional?
Well, the year of the Olympics.
No, I know, but like,
It was close. It was
close. See, we're close enough. All right. So, there's two more even though downtown though, right? How many are quote unquote downtown? Now that
we got Marietta Street down toward the College Football Hall of Fame.
Right.
You got Cortland at John Dobbs.
Right, but the College Football Hall of Fame and Centennial Park are like, that's less than a mile, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can walk between them. Yeah, we give our district managers auto allowances for their cars.
Right.
But as we started doing these urban ones, I floated the idea. I haven't been able to sell it. let's not do a car allowance. Let's do a bicycle allowance.
Okay.
And then with those, I thought we'd just do a shoe allowance.
A shoe?
Because I park at Centennial Park, and I walk to Marietta Street, and I walk over the hill to John Dobbs at Cortland.
There's another two that are just on the other side. Do you know the two that are the closest to each other? Because I think it's the ones that I'm thinking about. That they're literally like, if you go right off the freeway, it's right there. And if you go left, it's right there. I want to say it's 285, and I can't think of it, but they're really close.
Well, we have several double ups. We started that in 1983, Claremont in 85. Number 10 was on the Decatur side, and number 489 was on the other side of I-85.
What kind of market research do you have to do to figure out, this will be profitable, even though it's right across? Like, how is it number of cars that drive by? How do you make that decision?
Well, we don't do any market research, but we do go spend time looking at the sites. And the good news about filling in the markets we're in, we already operate in all these markets. So if you think, well, What about that? We've got a lot of familiarity. Going out to the new places was tougher when we first went to Arizona. I went, and I'd stand on every one of those sites in the middle of the night. And my dad used to say, take a pot of hot coffee out there and look at the traffic. If you can pour it before it gets cold, thinking customers would stop and drink it, you can probably do business there. And we can do business daytime almost anywhere if you've got access and ID. That is, they can see you and they can get to you. The real question is whether you'll have a night shift.
Well, some folks would say they only eat at the Waffle House at night, but that's weekends, right?
That's all they admit to.
I admit to eating it 24/7, and it's much more hip now. I'm sure you're aware of that. That it's very hip now to be like, oh, I eat at the Waffle House. When once upon a time it wasn't. It was, oh, we go there when we're drunk.
Well, it's funny how we've become something. Somebody asked me about that with the brand. I said, well, we're comfortable letting people have whatever brand association they want. Bert, famous of Bert's Chili.
Right.
Bert loved to go and talk to college classes. And he would always open with, now, show of hands, folks, how many of you have had a Waffle House experience? And hands would go up.
Right.
And then he'd say, how many of you have had a Wendy's experience? And Wendy's is a good place. They're a very good business.
Right.
But it's not an experience.
Right.
And I can't explain it. I live it, but I can't explain it. And people say, well, if you don't understand it, why are you in that business? I say, well, if I can't understand it, maybe our competitors can't understand it either. So,
do you get asked to consult for other businesses? Do people want to hire you to come in and not your competitors, obviously, but something else in a different industry?
No. I've done some civic work around Atlanta with the...
Nobody's brought you in and said, hey, man, we want to know what the secret sauce is. Can you help us grow this, whatever it is?
No. We tried to stay off of most people's radar screen. And we like to help civically, the Children's Hospital System here in Atlanta.
Right.
We've tried to work with over the years and help. And Grady, when they privatized Grady and Georgia Tech... and Emory and the schools and things. But I've got a lot of friends in business. I'm glad to share things with them, and I learn a lot from them. Oftentimes, it's what not to do, which is just as valuable as learning what to do.
Who is taking over for you, sir?
Well, we've got a great generation reality. I'm 74.
Okay.
Our CEO just turned 55.
Okay.
I've got two active of my three children. Two of them are active and are executive VPs. One is about to be 37. One's about to be 35. So there's a 20-year and another 20-year.
So you're in good shape.
And they're bringing along wonderful people in that generation because we're an entry-level business, totally homegrown. So if you know what an organization chart looks like. And if you just do an organization chart of our restaurants, which is now 1,800-plus company restaurants... Everybody on that organization chart in operations started as a single unit trainee, ran one, went to a district, three, a division, approximately nine, an area. Nobody ever skipped a step. So it takes 7 to 17 years to get into senior management. And it's a totally homegrown management team, very unique culture.
Has somebody approached you to make the Waffle House end-all, be-all documentary?
No. Well, yeah, we've probably been approached, but once again, we do a lot of stuff internally for the culture.
Right.
Atlanta's our home. We're glad to, something like this, share a glimpse into history.
Right.
And some of the reality, because it's been an interesting history. I've watched this city since the 1950s, and certainly this industry in this city every day for the last 50 years. And it's been a wonderful ride, a great experience. But we've got enough work to do to row our own boat. So trying to row everybody else's boat is not one of the things we have in mind.
All right. So this is how I wrap up. I ask some Atlanta favorites questions. And the first question I ask people, every guest, not just you, is what is your go-to order at the Waffle House?
Everything that's on the menu. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. You don't have another person you ever interview who can say that. It's not on there.
I can't let you get away with that, though. What are you going to eat if you walk into one today, tomorrow? What are you going to order?
My breakfast yesterday was a ham omelet,
okay,
sliced tomatoes, and wheat toast. Trivia question.
Okay.
What was the first time you could get sliced tomatoes instead of grits at the Waffle House?
When?
Yeah. When was the first time?
I have no idea.
Labor Day, 1955.
Because?
It's been there since the beginning. Little known secret. We used to charge extra for hash browns. We didn't make the switch to the three of them, hash browns, grits, or sliced tomatoes, until the early 90s.
All right. Well, I guess I got to ask the obvious one. I'm going to go off my questions real quick. Who did invent the nomenclature that is so world famous?
Well, over time it evolved. I had to get rid of the slang, the old Toddle House system, and it came over into the Waffle House system. You'd order a wheel strip, an order of Country Brook. Give me an order of Country Brook Seaboard. That was an order of Country Scrambled Eggs, Brookfield Sausage. Seaboard is to go for the railroad.
Interesting.
So it was all slang. Wheel strip was a waffle bacon.
Right.
And I had to get rid of the slang and get it back to the, at least the name of the food.
Not the brand name.
Yeah, the hash browns.
Right.
Scattered, smothered, covered.
Right, but who said scattered? Who said smothered?
Well, we learned that from the cooks, because it was always in the rings on the menu. The cooks, on the other hand, you'd watch them, and they'd scatter their hash browns on the grill to get them a little crisper. And then when nobody's looking, they'd throw onions and cheese and ham and stuff. We didn't have mushrooms. That only came 20 years ago.
Okay.
And they'd throw this stuff into
capped
the hash browns.
Is mushrooms.
Yes. You got it. And
I told you I'm a Waffle House
gravy.
Fan.
We had chili, so it could be topped.
Right.
Country is gravy. And so gradually all this evolved, but it all means something. Like when the servers call out the orders, they'll say, drop two. I said, no, drop two hash browns. Why do I need to say that? The cook knows what I want. What you're saying is like a music, is music to the ears of the customers. We're marketing what we're serving to all the customers in the restaurant.
But when did you figure that part out? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, when I was a server.
That customers, did they smile when you yelled out that?
Sure.
Or?
And then I'd call out an order and another customer, what was that? And they'd ask me. And I'd say, well, that's this. Oh, I'll have that.
So what is the most recent version? You said mushrooms is 20 years ago. What's the latest?
The latest item that we've added?
No, I mean in terms of on top of hash browns. If capped is the most, is capped the most recent? Is something past?
Gravy came after mushrooms.
Okay. And what is gravy?
Country.
And what year is that?
Judy had it up in Ohio, and then we picked it up maybe 15, 18 years ago.
All right. So nothing in the last 20 years?
Not really. Not really.
Something's coming. I think it's due then.
You do? We may have to simplify. Maybe time to take some things out.
What's jalapenos?
Bert wanted us to put the jalapenos in, and that's peppered.
Peppered. Okay, what am I missing? I think we've mentioned.
Scattered, smothered, covered, chunk, diced, top, peppered, and capped. Diced is tomatoes.
Right.
And scattered all the way is all of those things, plus gravy, plus chili.
Is there a secret menu? Can I go in and order something not on the menu that certain folks will know how to make me?
There is a two different menus. There's a menu you see.
Right.
I got to ask, because Joseph, my son, just changed the menu to a simpler menu for the pandemic and the labor that we've got, and simplified the prices. So there's a whole new approach there. But we did have the bigger menu was the shorter menu. The smaller menu was the longer menu. And I tried to get them to get rid of it and said, just write down on a piece of paper a list of all the items that aren't on the menu. Like the old Home Depot little marketing things.
Mm-hmm.
Just write it, put it on a little tablet, and let the associates give it to the customers and say, now don't show anybody this, but this is the secret menu. But they've not been willing to do that yet. So maybe that's still in our future.
All right, so back to my Atlanta questions. Again, I ask everybody this, so don't be thrown off. Do you have a favorite restaurant in Atlanta currently?
Whichever Waffle House I am in.
Is the favorite
is
one?
Absolutely. Not only my favorite restaurant, my favorite servers, my favorite cooks,
Publix or Kroger?
Oh, I like them both. Publix in Florida, Kroger in Ohio.
Okay.
If I'm shopping.
Okay.
There's a difference. Publix in Florida operationally versus some of their outer things, and a Kroger in Cincinnati versus some of their outer markets. There's a big difference.
All right. Rank these in importance to you. Falcons, Braves, Hawks, United.
Braves, Falcons, Hawks, United. I've never been to a United game. I still need to go.
Me either.
I had season tickets when the Hawks first came to town, but I was living downtown, so it was easy to get to. And now that the Braves have moved near where I live, so I think convenience may influence that decision.
Right. Are you friendly with Ted Turner?
Or what?
Are you friendly with Ted Turner?
Acquainted.
Acquainted. Well, I assume when all, you know, when he was owning all the sports teams, right?
Yeah, he was traveling in different circles than I was. I was in the restaurants, and we weren't wheeling and dealing. He's been quite an institution. And what an asset for Atlanta.
I think so.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely.
All right. I always ask folks this question. Who should I have next on the Atlanta podcast?
What's your objective? Is it Atlanta history? Is it?
It's anybody interesting. You know, I've spoken to artists, rappers, chefs, you know, regular business folks. I've talked to all kinds of, you know, I talked to the Beltline, Ryan Gravel, the guy that came up with the Beltline right. idea. So it's honestly, it's anything Atlanta related that I think is interesting.
Well, if you can coax Jerry Greenbaum to come to town, Leonard Greenbaum's son, Green's Liquor Store.
Oh.
And that history that they've had. And
right.
I think Jerry's son has done a couple of restaurants at California Dreaming concept things like that.
Right.
And Jerry knows a lot of history. And, of course, I saw Dan Cathy the other day. And I first met his dad, Truett, Chick-fil-A, when I was building a restaurant down in Hapeville in 1966. And right down from what was then their small headquarters building. And that family's got a lot of continuity. I don't know where the old Hickory House, who's still around that's left from the old Hickory House restaurant group. And I'd have to think there's some other old line restaurants around Atlanta, but they're few and far between these days.
Right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming in. This was a lot of fun. More fun than I thought. I you know, I don't know you personally.
Right.
You are a very behind-the-scenes guy. It's not like there's all kinds of video on you out there. And so I just know how much I love Waffle House. And so I reached out to your people and said, you know, would Joe be willing to talk? And here we are. So thank you for doing
this. Glad to do it. Good luck.
There you have it. That was Joe Rogers Jr. I hope you learned something. I hope you were entertained. I hope you will go to the Waffle House and continue to make them a success. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm always looking to help spread the word on this podcast. People talk about reviews a lot, and they're fine. And if you want to leave a review, I'll take it. But the best thing you can do is tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on socials. Tell a friend, hey, I just listened to this podcast. It's awesome. It's great people. Matt's entertaining.